Would you play the Lament for Limerick?
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Poet Radio. It's December 2025, and I'm with Robert Kelly and Charlotte Mandel. Robert was a guest on the seventh edition of WGXC's Poet Radio back in April 2016. Today we're recording the 123rd edition of the show, and I'm really glad that the meeting with Robert and Charlotte at their home in Annandale on Hudson could be arranged. Can't think of a finer way to conclude another year of the program being on the air. I'm very pleased we could arrange this session as an interval within WGXE's year-end fundraiser, Wave on Main, on air, online, on Main Street. As many listeners may be aware, we are expanding the WGXE Catskill studio, and we need your support. Help us grow the space in the coming year for community programming, workshops, in-studio performances, and more. Your donation to Wave Farms WGXC, Radio for Open Ears, contributes to the expansion of community radio on air, online, and on Main Street. Go to wgxc.org/donate now to make your contributions. As always, we will be grateful for your support. It's the day after winter solstice, and I thought it might be nice to begin by reading a poem Charlotte and Robert sent out over the network yesterday, simply titled Winter Solstice 2025. Is this okay? Winter Solstice 2025. The light comes back to take us by the hand, leads us out of the dark to what comes next. We move with it, exalted by the thought of what lives beyond the light. Now here, someone may very well tune into the hope and possibility, maybe even the relief of the line, to what comes next. But certainly we can indeed be more carried away, if not exalted, by considering or speculating on the idea of, quote, what lives beyond light, and thinking of ways that can and does occur. I've been envisioning this conversation as a bit of a fireside chat, and maybe we can begin there, Robert, with what lives beyond light.
I'm glad you asked. I wish I knew the answer. But it's the question that's been haunting me, not just the past few days, but in general. We feel in all of our post-18th century notions of progress and science, we always think of the illumination, the enlightenment, the going towards the light. But what is light about? I've been working, not yet on paper, on a story involving a Chinese-Tibetan scientist at the University of Chengdu in Nanshan who discovers that light is a particle, particulate, and that given two particles of X and Y, he'll name them, light produces, that it doesn't come from the sun's fiery light, it comes from stimulation of these particles, and that you can do it in your pocket. I'm curious about it because the question that presents itself to us steadily as we look around the world is that the only thing that we can chase sort of not quite material is light. We don't quite see it as matter. We see it as something that happens, an event rather than a thing. And that haunts me. What is it that could, is there such a thing as beyond thing? Is there an event out there waiting for us? Anyway, those things interest me. But I'm guessing that what is beyond light is, I wrote another piece this past week in which I talk about, it's a more comic piece. I say that, you know, the way when you get a sleep analysis by your machine or the hospital, they'll give you so many minutes of light sleep, so many minutes of REM sleep, so many minutes of deep sleep. So I wanted a poem that talked about so many minutes of light waking, so many minutes of think waking for REM, and how many minutes of deep waking. Is there a deep waking? Something, and the word deep always suggests to us, doesn't it, the dark, something out there beyond, out in the deep. Is there a deep waking? Is there something in that sense beyond light? Oh, that's just been on my mind lately.
I flex my brain on this for a moment, and the thing that came up to first, of course, was those sea creatures who live so far down in the ocean that they have to create their own their own light. They've evolved so that the they have little lamps out in front of their head. These fish. Beyond that, I couldn't really come up with anything that we know of per se. Even in deep space, wouldn't there be some form of light from the sun, even a sun in another galaxy or whatnot? So, but this is a thing. This is what, I don't know, makes the poem. The poem is this sort of contemplation or speculation or what we can do and what we need to do, maybe. And maybe it's a charge for us to, like you say, you've been puzzling over this for some days. So maybe this is our charge.
And perhaps the dark has something to tell us, too. We talk about darkness, but is there something that is neither light nor dark? That might be part of the beyondness.
Well, happy solstice, in any case, Robert, and I'm glad to be with you here. To continue on a seasonal thread, I'm wondering if you have any distinctive poetic end-of-year memories, or if there are any holiday themed poems or stories that have stuck with you over time.
May I growl now? I'm a big enemy of holidays. I think every day is holy day. And even though I was raised a devout Catholic and respect all those holy days, I like it that there are many of them. Every day has a saint attached to it. And I hate the way in which we sequester positivity and put it one day a week, if we're Jews or Christians or Muslims, or we sequester reality and push it to a holiday. I want every day to be holy. So I don't know how to win them. Anyway, I don't have any special holiday-ish remembrances.
You have a poem about having Thanksgiving dinner in an automat with your parents. You don't remember why. It was on Thanksgiving Day.
And it was a shock to the little American child I was that we weren't doing fancy things. And I don't know why it happened that way, but it was a very great instruction to me. Do you remember the automats? Did they survive in your youth?
Barely. I was with Allen Ginsberg in Times Square one time, and he was giving me this tour of, oh, there was a great automat here, and there was a great automat here. And at that time, it was the 1980s, I think there was one left.
There was one on 43rd Street at one time. One of the last ones left was over near the Daily News building on the East 4th. But the wonderful thing about the automat that changed the whole thing from a bad memory into a joyous one was the spouts, the spigots, through which coffee, tea, and other things came. Do you remember that? You slipped in a quarter or whatever it was, and there was a lion's head, and from the lion's mouth came out a stream of coffee into your cup.
I didn't. Well, the interesting thing is that New York City, of course, has changed so much. But if you go down to, like, St. Mark's place, they now have these automat-like things, but they're for Korean ice cream. Or, you know, they're it's the same concept, but, you know, just no personal interface. You just pay and something comes out of the, you know, out of the machine. But I do remember seeing that. I mean, everything changed down there drastically. Well, another point of instigation I thought to bring in to the conversation is that for the past year, I've been producing and editing the transcripts of several dozen radio interviews I've conducted. And one of the things I noticed while doing so is that many guests on this program draw on Robert's and Bernadette Mayer's work as touchstones, including Ann Gorick, Joel Neuberger, Jerome Rothenberg, Nancy Dunlop, Dorota Scherner, Brenda Coltis, Tomas Penitz, etc. In certain ways, this fact makes perfect sense, since Robert began teaching at Bard in 1961, I think, and Bernadette was connected to the Berkshires for several decades. Still, it fascinates me that these two poets have held such sway over the attentions and aesthetics of so many writers who have connection to the region. I'm not surprised at all, of course, given the tenacity, prodigiousness, and quality of their output, not to mention their own perseverance of craft, and I'm glad that these
were so different, they all from one another.
Yes. I'm glad these radio conversations that I've had as a whole reflects a kind of regional poetics that often stems from your work. I'm not certain that it was all intentional for these writers to serve as an example for others, and haven't developed a specific question for Robert and Charlotte about any of this, though I'm hoping you might be able to share some impressions on how the Hudson River Valley evolves as a location for poets and poetry over the years. Being at Bard, where students enroll to study poetry and writing, you've seen many students and professors come and go. It also seems like a lot of people stay in the region, and there must be reasons for that, some of which might be obvious, others being more subtle. Everyone would have their own. So,
Well, I'll give you my... I'm thoroughly unreasonable, thoroughly irrational explanation. The era we're in right now, north of Rhinebeck, say, you know the highway, say north of the bridge road, 199 where it comes over the bridge, north of that and south of the Tivoli marshes, that era, this area was a crucial region for the American Indians who lived here. No one lived here. It was the place where they met. It was a place of conversation and discourse. So they would, I mean, tribes who lived in the Esopus across the river, or down on the island, the Esopus Island, or tribes that lived in Millerton or closer, like Chicomico, they would come and meet here and talk. And never fighting here. And I think that piece, which is, by the way, reflected in an extraordinary number of Indian artifacts, including religious things, found in the local stream, not the Sawkill, but an affluent of the Sawkill, that are Bard's archaeologist, Chris Linder. Do you know him? Christopher Linder. It's the only stream north of Georgia, I believe, in which medicinal gemstones have been found. And many of those have been sent to a museum in Germantown. You might look there. So.
In Germantown?
In Germantown, there's a kind of, some sort of town museum. Anyway, Christopher Lindner is his name, a very nice man. He doesn't say all the rest of what I'm saying, but I'm observing that because of the crucial nature of the region, it became a word, a place of word. And I think, too, I'm not the first poet who hit the road here, I mean, who got off the road. When I came here, there was a famous literary magazine called the Quarterly Review of Literature, which was edited by a poet who had brought a few of the poets to teach her, including most notably James Merrill, who was the best known poet. And then came along me, and then Anthony Hecht, and many others. And there seemed to be some remarkable thing in which then I brought, I guess I brought Quasha and Chuck Stein, and their contingents, their friends, many of them came for them, and they had been great magnets for the region. So from that point of view, and Dorota and Russell, who now live up on the hill in Kingston, originally lived in Rhinebeck, right, part of the crucial domain. So I think there's something in that sense I should probably say logical, i.e. vertical, magical, logical about the region that offers us. But while I have lived here, I have developed gradually, I hope your listeners forgive this, they have developed an almost sacred sense of what I call hylophrasis, or a form of hylonoetic, which is a form of hylozoic. Peter Lamon Rosa, our friend, our late wonderful poet, used to talk about the hylozoic, a matter is alive. And I would correct him and say, no, hylonoetic, matter thinks. And then I corrected myself to say, hylophrasis, or hylonoetic, matter speaks. And the speaking of matter is what has been haunting me for the past few years. It's a Rilkean notion. I think we can find it in Rilke perfectly well. And it came to me first. Can I be personal?
Yeah, sure.
I was standing in Leipzig, Germany, in the church, the so-called Thomaskirche, the St. Thomas Church. And I was leaning against the wall, and suddenly I heard Bach playing in the stone. Well, I thought I did, or I tricked myself into believing that, or I thought. And then I look up, and there's Bach's tomb lying in front of me, and there's the same wall that had listened to his playing there, Sunday after Sunday. Yeah. I could not get over that experience, and it gradually had spread to the point where I find stone, wood, and water constantly talking. In this listening through sense, I'm not hearing the water saying boo, boo, boo. I'm hearing what it makes me think. So stone, wood, water make us think.
Mm-hmm.
And what they think, we have to pay attention. So all my poems in recent years have been constantly kind of boring. Listen, and you get it. Listen, and you hear. How can you hear without listening?
Right, right. There's another local poet. I don't know if you would know him or his book, Michael Ruby. He wrote a sort of a transcription of the summer sounds of this area in the summertime, you know, the insects and frogs and all the others. But
he was writing about them? Or
No, he was... They were talking to him. He was sort of divining.
Good for him.
Yes, yeah, so sometimes very literal sounds, but at other times, manifest in language as well. So that's we have plenty of wood and stone and blue stones and the river nearby. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's part of the explanation of a commonality, the people who pass through here or mm-hmm. settle here, whether they know it or not, and they probably don't know it. You know it, but, yeah. You know, who knows?
It took me 50 years to know it. I mean, I've lived here for how many years? 65, 60 years. And it took me a long time to learn that, where my thoughts were coming from.
That's really interesting, Robert. And so maybe we would be saying, well, actually, it's not Robert Kelly and Bernadette Mayer who are the influences. It's our surroundings and you're sort of, whether you know it or not, leading that charge. But how does a work like this is a hypothetical question. You can disregard it. How does a work like The Loom, for example, how does that come out of these?
Well, The Loom came long before.
Okay. I can't remember the years. You didn't write it here.
I wrote it in California.
Oh, all right.
In a remarkably focused way. I had been told when I was a kid I was a very fat child. Did you know me in my fat era?
Only in the photographs. No.
I was a pretty fat fellow. And I was told by the physicians, you've got a short life, kid. You'll be dead by 35. And the day after my 36th birthday, I was living in Los Angeles. At the time, I began The Loom, and I wrote it joyously, continuously, day after day, working on it. I had come through. I had survived. My getting to 36 was my liberation. Is that stupid to say? Yes, I suppose so. But it felt so. And the loom was the longest continuous thing I had ever done. I'd done some longer ones before that. Axon Dendron Tree, do you know that? It's an earlier and rather more, what we would have called then, non-objective poem.
So the sense, though, of being the surroundings, well, maybe being in California was crucial to the authorship there, but it was really, do you think it was coming to the Hudson Valley was influential on the writing?
Oh, very much so. I remember very much so.
Your recent book is called Lindenward, and the tree in our backyard is a linden tree. There's a lot of poems in that is about listening to trees.
The last guest I had on this program is a woman named Evelyn Riley, and Evelyn has done a lot of work with trees as well, I believe, and this idea that, you know, I remember after COVID, well, in the middle of COVID somewhere, there was an installation in Central Park where they had, you know, used technology to mark trees, and number of people were invited to contribute work to that, including myself. And so it was about what the trees spoke to us. So this is an interesting poetic idea, and I did not know that you were involved with it either. Now
I'm almost obsessed with it. But what where I get angry is the way in which people think that because they have named the genus, species, subspecies of a tree, they know something about it. Whereas in fact, naming myself as Homo sapiens doesn't tell me much about me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's necessary to, I wouldn't say reject, but stand back a little from the typical ecological preoccupation with trees. And the health. By the way, one of my enemies is the Christmas tree. In that, everyone should have one, i.e. plant one. Never tear down a tree to honor Christ. What a bad idea.
That's fair enough. Mm-hmm. But now we have these huge tree farms, you know, that hopefully, you know,
they'll send out their scouts to get me.
No, they won't. But the next thing that this was reminding me of is you must have known Jackson McClough when he was up here at Bard.
Indeed.
So one thing that really blew my mind was seeing a film that he made at Bard, which is called A Tree Movie. And he just trained a camera on a tree for 6 hours or more. And that was, it was a Fluxus thing, right, where it was more conceptual. But I was really, really moved by this film, and I started making them myself. Every year I make at least one tree movie where I take a half an hour, I might put my camera on a tripod. And this is so fascinating. I mean, if we just meditate on a tree, before a tree, this is an action movie. You know, but not like a Hollywood action movie, right? It's like, most recently, maybe about 5-6 weeks ago, I made a tree movie in my front yard in Tivoli, and it was so action-packed. There were so many birds. There was so much wind and things flying through the air and all this stuff. So, I mean, trees give us so much.
Do you remember Bruce Bailey when he was at Bard? Filmmaker, great experimental filmmaker.
I don't think so. Bruce Bailey?
Bailey.
No.
Still alive, perhaps, or recently did. He did a movie of panning slowly down a fence, a hedge. Extraordinary. One of the great things that happened here at Bard and in this whole region was not just the poetry, but the movies. Somehow it didn't happen with painting. It didn't happen with sculpture in quite that way. But suddenly, we had Brackage here, we had Bailey here, we had the Meccas and his brother here. And I think that during that period of maybe 20 years between the development of the film program in the 1970s and the late 90s, Barbecue was a remarkable place for film and poetry. And we had, of course, John Ashbery here. Did you get to interview John?
No, I didn't. I've friends of the Flowchart Foundation, and they have been on the people from the Flowchart have been here a couple of times. But I didn't know John Ashbery. I maybe got here a couple of years before he was gone, something like that. But I just didn't have the same patterns, I suppose, as Ashbery. Although I ended up liking his work quite a bit in the end. I didn't understand it at first, but then once I figured out a way to read it.
One does have to do that, yes.
Something like that.
To have him come here was extraordinary because he represents an entirely non-prophetic, if we put it that way, non-prophetic kind of poetry, a very actual, focused on the conversation rather than on biblical prophecy.
I much enjoyed reading John Ashbery's letters in an archive one time. I thought it was more lively than the poetry, even. And it's a compliment to his poetry. And the letters were just so funny and lively and daring and, you know, really lots of bravado that I could appreciate. So I guess thank you for talking a bit about your perspective on the area and Bard and what more there is than just the poetry and the poets passing through. I think that's instructive to know. And of course it's true. One of the things I always think of is that we're so close to New York City. I mean, we're at a distance, but close enough so that there is a sort of flow between. But you know, as I was saying before, there's a kind of a critical mass has developed at times, and I would say even now with you and Chuck and George are still here, and Joan Retallick has been here, and Otterback, and so it's it's not just it's convenient for New Yorkers to come up to the area, but it's there's nurturing. There's not only an institution, but there are the mountains, and, you know, the Great Hudson River, and all this stuff to feed us, you know, somehow in different ways.
And another source of that energy, before you got here, John Cage, and Dick Higgins, the wonderful Dick Higgins, who made baritone possible. Baritone would not be George Land without Dick hadn't been here.
I did meet him one time.
You did?
In Barrytown, actually. Uh-huh. When I was a graduate student, Don Bird brought me down here, and we were at some event at George and Susan's, and Dick was there. It was very...
Don Bird. Is he still with us?
Yes, he is. Yes. He
Say
is.
Hello if you speak with him.
Okay, I sure will.
So you were a student at Albany?
I got my PhD at Albany with Pierre and Don. That's when I met Pierre. He was part of my. He was one of my professors.
Pierre has been so good to us. We to him too, I guess. We tried. Charlotte moved briskly and easily from being a recently graduated young woman into being a professional translator, instant, overnight, through Pierre's kind recommendation.
Tell
Christopher about that.
He was asked by Stanford University Press to translate a work of Fire by Bonchot, and he didn't have time, so he recommended me, and I sent in a sample, and that was my first book. A book of Blanchot.
Great.
Yeah.
Imagine beginning with Blanchot.
That was like 25 or something.
And you've done 60 books since then. Proust now. just working on
Proust. Well, it was a tough year for poetry in the loss of Pierre and Cole Heinowitz to the region. And I know Pierre gained so much by being at Bard and connected with Bard and you. And I knew of you and your work before I met Pierre, just by a year or two. And he was certainly championed your work and brought you to Albany several times.
Yes,
while I was there. And here we are. And it's lucky to know these people.
I cannot think of any non-urban location that has had such a concentration of high art as this region. I used to say we should start the School of Barrytown.
The School of Barrytown?
The School of Barrytown. Chuck is getting old and George is getting old and I have gotten old. We don't want to do that. Well, old is good to be, you know.
Well, I've been smitten by the School of Barrytown for sure. It's one of the things I first recognized was within the first, say, 6 months of doing this radio program, you, Chuck, George, Joan, all live within about a mile of each other or so, right? There was some critical mass I haven't really, well, this conversation is, maybe helping.
Dick Higgins and Franz Kamen, they were there too. And Susan Wilkins, who lived across the street, a poet.
Right.
Such a cluster there were there. And it all seemed perfectly normal. It was a grand place. But I think that what I was saying earlier about the Tuchel region has a lot to do with it. We've been summoned here.
I want to remind listeners that this is Poet Radio on WGXC, and it just so happens that this is a WGXC end of the year fundraiser, so I'm going to pardon everything else at the moment and say WGXC's Catskill Studio has become a grounding place for our station. But we're expanding that situation, and with your help, we now have the opportunity to do even more community-based programming, workshops, and in-studio performances. So your donation to Wavefarms WGXC Radio for Open Ears contributes to the expansion of this, and you can donate to be a monthly donor, you can send in a one-time donation, but you need to do all that via wgxc.org/donate. This is radio for on air, online, and on Main Street in Catskill. So do that if you can. We'll be very grateful.
Did I ever tell you how I came to Bard?
I haven't heard the story, no.
I'll tell it. Can I tell it, Charlene? I've been teaching at Wagner College, my first teaching job. At the end of that, I said, oh, no, I'm not going to do this ever again. I'll go back to translating. I had, for several years, worked as a translator, written, technical, scientific, medical. And then I got a call one day from the young poet Jonathan Green, who was a student at Bard at that time. He said, there was an opening suddenly for someone to teach German. We thought you should come and do it. And I said, none in your life. I'm not going to do any more teaching. Then the next day, I got a phone call from the English poet who was here at that time, Paris Leary, with whom I had done that Controversy of Poets anthology. He was here teaching poetry. Paris already. He said, please come up. It would be such nice to have you here. You can teach German. The German teacher had just run off with a student at the end of the term. In those days, Bard terms ran to the end of June, and by the end of June, everybody had their jobs set for the fall. The next day, I said no. The next day, Rima Klein, the president of the college, called me and said, oh, just come up for a visit, have a look. So I said, all right. So I got on the bus, came to Kingston, where he waited for me, the president of the college, in his little Volkswagen. A man as tall as I twice his size. We crammed into the little car and drove here, and I met the people of Bard. And then they showed me the apartment they would give me. Oh, you can have this place. Now, I, who lived in a Brooklyn dive, was suddenly shown a 30-foot living room with a fireplace and a terrace and a bedroom and an office with shelves. And so I said, okay.
Well, it seems to work out pretty well so, for you, Robert.
It did indeed. And I've always hoped that... Then one day I was sitting on the lawn down at Byford, one of the lawn chairs, and I suddenly realized I'm in the right place. I had never had that feeling before of being in the right place. You know, when you live, did you ever live in New York?
In New York City?
Yes.
Yes, we did. And we lived on the island of Staten.
Yeah, where I talked, that was right.
Yeah.
Where did you live on Staten?
We lived in St. George.
Oh, right there.
Yeah, right near, very close to the ferry, historic district.
Do you know the diner with all the cute waitresses in it? Nurses. The nurses from the Naval Hospital went to a diner there, which is the only diner within walking distance of the ferry. So I'd get off the ferry in the morning, have a cup of coffee. And these remarkable, I don't mean pretty, but just in the sense of energetic young women. Or from the Naval Hospital.
That's what's interesting. I went to school in Albany, but I had no intention of, I was going to go wherever I could get a teaching position, really. And it just so happened that that was in New Jersey. We lived in New Jersey a number of years. It was my wife, Amy, who got the job at Olana, and that brought us back to the area because I had met her in Albany. And that once I got here in my adult life, really, and I don't want to. I won't live anywhere else. I'd be surprised in this country anyway.
Right.
I mean, we're.
Is Olana still vivid?
Well, it's a beautiful place. That's not going to change.
But it's not doing well.
Well, no, she's not working there anymore. But I've been there a couple of times lately. Very, very nice. Psychedelic Victorianism. That's what, that's what I call it.
A beautiful phrase.
Yeah.
I will not forget that phrase.
It's a very interesting place, but as when my wife was working there, she sort of led a charge to, you know, question some of the things that church did and what the house does. And she was allowed to do that, but in the end, she had to move on from that. And that's how careers are, actually, right?
So when you said church, what did you mean?
Frederick Church.
Oh, Frederick Church.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Oh, man, let me think. Could we draw that out to be something religious? Oh, I don't know. Yes, yeah. I'm sure we could, but we'll leave it at that for now. You know, I want to thank you so much for your time today, Robert, and we can finish up soon, but I felt it would be remiss not to ask you about what you've been working on lately and what your readers might expect to emerge in terms of books or other types of publications in the nearish future.
Oh. Well, those two books that just came out this past month, Listening Through, from Contra Mundum in New York, that press that did the two huge volumes of essays by me and about me, and then from a West Coast Wet Cement Press, The Symphonies. Waiting to come out any minute now, but I'm not quite sure from whom, because there's some discussion. It's a book called Metalogues, which is a series of poems written last summer, and that would be a book of about 120 pages. I'm hoping it'll be out by spring.
Did you say Meadowlarks?
Meadowlarks. M-E-T-A
Meadow, okay.
No, Meadowlogs.
Oh, logs.
Yeah, so you can describe what Meadowlogs is.
Like epilogue, Meadowlog.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I'm just playing with the notion of the word that is beside the word, that comes after the word. That's original metaphysics, you know, was named that because it was printed in the manuscript after the physics. So it was deep after the physics, metaphysics.
Mm.
But that gave to the sense of meta, not in Greek, the sense of something odd about that.
That's cool. That's interesting. I'm glad I asked, because that's the way language works, where you can hear three words in one single word. These are books of poems, and you said there was a book of writing on music. Is that right?
No. The two books that we're listening to is a book through music, not about it. It's not on music at all. I would not presume to write about music.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised with classical music. I never caught on to pop music, so I'm totally ignorant.
But you're sort of a researcher in various areas, including music. I mean,
I listen to odd things, but I'm very undisciplined.
Undisciplined.
Yeah.
One thing I was wondering was how I was wondering about your process of discovering and receiving information, new things. I mean, do you listen to books, on tapes, podcasts, or how do you?
Well, I'm moving into a world. As of the past 4 or 5 years, I'm not able to read anymore. So my life is, and since I have 10,000 books, and I've been reading books all my life, my first trip to the library at 5 years old, and they wouldn't let me take adult books out. But I persuaded them I could. So after 80 years of reading, I suddenly can't read anymore. And it is very much the eunuch and the brothel situation. Here they are, all these beautiful books, and they're just on the shelf. Charlotte reads to me sometimes, and there are many, as you know, technological devices on Word and other systems that read not necessarily very well, but they read. That has helped me in a way that has forced me to listen to the stones and the trees and the water. Since they keep talking, I don't have to pay them to talk, except by paying attention. Attention is the biggest payment we can have. Most people pay money rather than attention.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful, Robert. Thank you for saying that out loud, because I couldn't agree with you more. And it's a big lesson one can hopefully take away from experience. And so this process of listening instead of reading, is it at in terms of your writing, has that changed the process? I mean, obviously you can still write.
I can still write, and I write more than I had before. I typically write every day. In fact, if I don't write every day, I begin to. I listen to the words. Usually my writing begins, here's my story, folks. Usually I wake up in the morning and there'll be a word or a phrase in mind, and I listen to the word and wait for what comes next. And if you listen to a word, you usually find out what comes next. And I keep urging my students, a word about them in a minute, I keep urging my students not to have too many plans for the poem, to enter it barefoot and naked, so to speak, be confused, just hear the word and see what happens. Put down another word, see what happens. In this way, I think, the living poet can become a living part of the process. Because language is us. Language is us in the world. We have many different languages, but everyone is part of all of them. We issue from ourselves. We don't know what we want. If I ask you, what do you really want to do, Chris? What would you really want to do with your life? I mean, that's an embarrassing and, in a sense, an iniquitous question, because it implies that we have the power to choose one thing. And Americans are really stuck on this, I want this, I'm afraid. And I want them to say instead, I hear this, I want them to listen rather than to demand. I have in a poem this morning as a phrase of someone sitting on the sidewalk like a beggar, but a beggar who doesn't even put out his hands, who isn't even asking for coins, let alone for answers. Just that, not the answer, just here. Anyway, I mentioned students, and I wanted to see if it's legitimate to do that. I would like to call to your attention. You can edit this out as you want.
No, it's fine. I wanted to go back to that. When I showed up here, Robert was talking about selling me some poets.
And I found that, just as those other poets that we were talking about, from Maryland, Dick Higgins, and all the rest onward, came here. They continue to come. And there was some reference, my journal, some encyclopedic type company asked me once to write an autobiographical account, and my account was mostly listing the names of my students, the poetry students who had gone on to do something in the poetry world, from John Yao and Pierre onward through time. In recent years, they've come here in one way or another, either two-board, through-board, or round-board. Remarkable young poets. I think of Alana Siegel. Mm-hmm. Have you met her?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure.
She's 40 years old now. New to the business of writing, in that she's not published very much, but her writing is spectacular. And she is one of the best readers of her work I've ever heard. A poet named Lila Dunlap. Have you run into her?
Sure.
Good, good. She's in New Orleans now. Wish we could get her back here. Who did a remarkable, here's a new word for you, a remarkable, I hate to say it, a homeoglyphic translation of a Georgian epic. Lila lived with her husband in Georgia, the country, for several years. And the Georgians have an epic called, in translation, The Knight in the Panther Skin. And it's a 500-page epic poem, something like that. So she started translating it. The Georgian alphabet is different from ours. She would look at a Georgian word, which we see as squiggle, squiggle, lump, squiggle, 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 and she would read it as tomorrow. So she did this homeoglyphic reading. I was big on homeopathic medicine and homeophonic poetry, as you know. I have one homeophonic book called Irish. Do you know that book?
What's the title?
Irish.
Irish.
They're homeophonic translations of Paul Celan's poems, but sound by sound, not meaning by meaning. Irish is the way in German you say Irish. So the book is called E-A-R-I-S-H. One of his best poems is called Irish, the Irish. Anyway, but she did a translation of that, hundreds of pages, this intense activity. She has that kind of brilliance and energy. Maggie Zabgren, have you met her?
Sure, sure.
Yeah, good, good, good. And you know her work, it's expanded. She came by yesterday and read an extraordinary long poem in which she took Canto 90 of Ezra Pound and wrote into it. So it's now a 20-page poem, and you can't tell which is hers and which is hers.
Wow.
Extraordinary. And, of course, there's Thomas, whom you know.
Yes.
His work continues in writing, too. And Joel Newberger, you know him. You work.
Oh, Joel, yes, yeah. Sure.
Who else should I mention? You know Billy Chernikov, certainly.
I do, yeah.
Who else was I going to mention? Do you remember?
I think that's...
I made a quick list.
to look. It's a problem up with names once you start.
Dorota Charna, you know her work.
Who's that?
Dorota.
Oh, Dorota, sure. Yeah. Most of the people you're naming have been guests on this radio program.
I'm very glad you know it.
Yes, and my work is ongoing. There's always new people to meet. I don't know everyone, but well, thanks. Thank you so much, Robert, for sharing your perspective on the poetry and how it corresponds to where we are, and how it affects us as writers and people. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. I'm so glad to get to hang out.
I'm glad that you came. I'm glad seeing you, talking with you.
And I say, some recent poems if you want.
What's that?
I have some recent poems that I could read if you want.
You want to read them?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to, let's do that. I will just turn this on over. Thank you again, Robert.
Let me just say while she's looking that I think that one of the things I would warn most people concerned with poetry is warn them about is the issue of quality. People say, oh, this is a good poem, or this is a better poem, or he's a good poet, he's a bad poet. The important thing, and let them remember this when they write and when they read, is that what a poem is a word that has never been spoken before. And that's all it has to be. It can be a 10-line or 10,000-line, and it's never been there before. Mm. And by giving it into the language, you give it into the world. And by giving it into the world, you're giving it into our mind stream. So I think that, especially in schools, there's so much emphasis on relevance in poetry and quality and all that stuff. Why I like good poems better than bad poems, I think that's not the point.
Right. Well, this is reminds me of a conversation I had with George Quasha earlier this year. Uh-huh. He, and I think Robert Duncan said the similar thing, which is, there's no such thing as good and bad. I mean, or something to that effect. These judgments of good and bad aren't really helpful. You have to dig a little more deeply than that to understand. And for what's good for someone might not be good for someone else, sort of a situation. Okay, dear listeners, before we conclude the program, I wanted to remind you that indeed you've been listening to Poet Radio for the past hour. My name is Chris Funkhauser. Guests on the program today, Robert Kelly and Charlotte Mandel. A reminder that we are in the midst of our fundraising drive at the moment, the end of the year fundraising drive, and investing in local community spaces and media is more important than ever right now. Wave Farms WGXC Radio for Open Ears is committed to providing a platform for independent perspectives and creative expression in New York's Upper Hudson Valley. And in 2026, we're working to ground our WGXC Catskill studio as a nexus point for our community to create, learn, and come together. And we need your help. Go to wgxc.org/donate now to make your contributions. We thank you for your support. Happy holidays to everyone out there. I wish you well. We'll see you again in 2026. Here is Charlotte Mandel reading recent Robert Kelly poems.
These are just some recent poems from December, so they're all dated. I'll just read a couple. The first one is on December 15th. The Delaware. The Delaware was shallow, shy, the year we were there. We drove down 97 along the course of it, sometimes the river just a trickle along its own side, as if shrinking away from what it had been doing. For miles we'd drive alongside stretches of pure white bones, the stones, river bottom, the skeleton of a river, the part that stays when all the water goes. Almost embarrassing to see, almost frightening to think that this is always here, and where does water go? Too intimate, the river's insides. South of Port Jervis, the affluents pick up and help the flood on its way down to the ocean. But here, between Pennsylvania and New York, the bridges over here and there, Shohola, Narrowsburg, seem hardly needed. Some places you could walk across the stream. Or so I thought, but would not have dared. Still in the mind's eye I see those bones, small stones, beautiful. They could not have been whiter had they been a million years in ocean, washed like shells. And there they were, carpeting in sunlight, sometimes rain, the only water they taste for a week. We crossed over into Pike County, spent our playtime there, solemnly as trees. Mostly I thought about rivers. Mostly I thought about whatever you think about when you're a little bit afraid of where you are and what you might have to be seeing next. It's December 15th. And then another one on the same day. America is halfway there. Where? To be the island it needs to be, washed by every sea, every language whispering in its trees. And then there's one called Howe Caverns, December 16th. Howe Caverns. I walked there, down there, when I was young, along the cold, dark stream, squeezed through rock walls, underneath the earth. Half a mile? Was it that far? There and back, always on a safe walkway, with a railing to hold onto, electric lights, bare bulbs along the rock. They had civilized the interior of the earth so that tourists would come enjoy. What would they enjoy? What I loved was the dark water, cold air and hot summer, the sense of being deep inside what I was never inside before. I loved the dark cave, but loved the electric light that tamed the interior. I pray that such a light could rise and tame the insides of everything. Mm-hmm. And then one more?
Sure.
This is December 17th. Then the word turned inside out, and an old MG came roaring up the road along the cliffs, but I couldn't see what country this was in or who was driving. Two. I tried to twist the word, then outside out again. The car was gone, the cliffs still there. Halfway there? Ireland again? Too warm, too many trees. I plucked an orange and went home.
Was it a dream?
No.
No? A memory? What's that? You're just following the words. Yes, of course.
Maybe one more. Experimental theology. Before you leave your home today, decide. Commit yourself to being whichever of the great deities or saints you are going to impersonate today. Be Mercury or Athena as you toddle through the town, or sit in the office, or drive your car, striving to St. Francis as you stroll about. Don't fake the part with costumes or tools. Just be that god. In this way, you'll give your town opportunity to welcome, come in contact at least or again or still with the gods, their cherished beliefs. As you walk about, you will be giving to all who see you, as they look towards you, a glimpse of the holy. Then suddenly, maybe at the moment of thunder or flash of light, or just suddenly, you will see who they are too, the deities among whom you live every day.